Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. To understand why people become sexual abusers, we need to understand the why of dysfunctional families. Today, a look at a Bible family scandalized by abuse and its damage. Then we'll see how God can heal the deep scars left behind. From the Moody Church in Chicago, this is Running to Win with Dr. Erwin Lutzer, whose clear teaching helps us make it across the finish line. Today we continue a three-part series on how to handle being the victim of sexual abuse. Our theme is simply, let God redeem your story. And now, Pastor Lutzer comes with part two.
I'm speaking on the topic, the sensitive topic of abuse. And as I mentioned last time, if you wish to weep while I speak, because memories are coming back that are very difficult for you to handle, feel free to do so, at least to cry quietly. And I hope that those of you who have experienced abuse in your life of whatever kind will be open on the Godward side. And maybe you'll hear something today that you've never really heard before. And I pray that it will be transforming for you. The purpose of this message, first of all, is for us to discuss what an abusive, dysfunctional family looks like. What happens in a family like that? What are the dynamics? And then the last part of the message is going to be on healing. How does Jesus heal the broken hearts? Thanks for being with me on this journey. I begin today with a story that some of you will probably recognize if you're familiar with the Old Testament. I came from a large, dysfunctional, blended family. My father was a very powerful and famous man. He had several wives. They said I was beautiful. I was a virgin. My half-brother was sick, at least that's what he told our father. He asked if I could come and fix him a meal. My father sent me a message, and he asked me to go to my half-brother. So, of course, I went. He was lying down and wanted me to make a cake for him in the kitchen. Then my half-brother said, "Bring the food to the bedroom and feed it to me." I can't believe that I trusted him. I should have known that something was wrong. I can't believe I was this naive. He even told everyone around to leave. I should have left with them. Then he grabbed me and said, "Come to bed with me, my sister." I knew that I was then in trouble. I said, "Don't, my brother, don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? Where would I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You would be like one of the wicked in Israel." But nothing worked. He was very strong, so he sexually assaulted me. Then he kicked me out as if I were the bad one. I remember pleading, "No, no, sending me away would be a greater wrong than what you've already done to me." He called his servants and said, "Get this woman out of here. Bolt the door after her." It was as if I was trash. I was violated, discarded, shamed, nameless, exposed. I tore my clothes and put ashes on my head, put my hand on my head, and went away crying. And nobody did anything. My father, King David, was angry, but he never came to me and never spoke to my half-brother about what happened. Well, the story, of course, is recorded in the 2 Samuel chapter 13. 2 Samuel chapter 13. If you have your Bibles, it's important that you follow along with the text. It's on page 264. Page 264, if you have a Bible like mine. And what I'd like to do is to give you some characteristics of a dysfunctional family, and then we'll talk about Tamar's possibility of being healed. What happens if you aren't healed, and what happens if you are, and why the difference? First of all, with reference to the family itself, I need to give you some background. In the Old Testament, God tolerated polygamy. And so David had many wives, and that meant, of course, that there were many brothers and half-brothers and half-sisters. Absalom and Tamar are from the same mother. Both of them were drop-dead good-looking. That's what the Bible says in my rather loose translation. They must have had a very beautiful mother. Amnon was from a different mother. He was actually the oldest of one of David's wives, and so that sets up the scenario as to what's going to happen between the half-brother Amnon and his half-sister, the beautiful sister Tamar. One of the things that you notice about dysfunctional families that is very evident is not all family members are protected, or we could say that not all of them are treated equally. That certainly was true in this case. Look at what the text says in chapter 13, verse 1. Now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. Now, wait a moment. Notice that Absalom is referred to as David's son, and later Amnon is referred to as David's son. But nowhere do we find that Tamar is referred to as David's daughter. Isn't that interesting? You see, in many cultures, even in the Middle East, the girls are sometimes more expendable and the men are more important. It would have been nice for her dignity, since she was a princess and her father was the famous David, if the text had said that she was the daughter of King David. But it doesn't say it. And by the way, if you're in a dysfunctional family, isn't it important for you to understand how words are used? It says that Amnon loved his half-sister. Loved? Are you kidding? You know, there are many people who say, I love you, and what they really mean is, I love myself and I want you. Amnon was nothing but an adult predator in terms of relationship to his half-sister. But, you know, love is used to cover what is going to become a horrendous crime. And isn't that the way it is? A molester says to children, well, you know, I'm just teaching you how to love, or I care so much about you. And so language is used to deceive. There's a second characteristic, and that is that appearance masks reality. The appearance is one thing, the reality is another. You know, if we had the time, we'd go back to chapter 12 as it ends. David is a great hero. Now, it's also true that he committed adultery and murder, and we know that story, but God forgave him. And now he's called into battle against the Ammonites, and they capture the king of the Ammonites, and they take his crown and they put it on David's crown. And all the people are cheering and saying, isn't it wonderful that we have such a great royal family? Well, what they don't know is that this royal family is dysfunctional and in trouble. In fact, it becomes very clear that even as the story unfolds, what happens is this. Tamar is told by her father to go to Amnon, who said that he was sick and he wanted Tamar to make some food that he might eat out of her hand. David, wake up, okay? I mean, don't you get it? I mean, Amnon was somebody who was not a very pretty young man. Now, he was in line for the throne, and so David turned the other way. And there's evidence that we shall uncover here that David was not a good father. And so the reality of what is happening is masked, and everybody on the outside thinks that the royal family's doing well. And David is famous for winning battles, but he has no idea as to how to control his sons and control his home. Isn't that true of a lot of people? They may be very good at their business and are successful, but when it comes to knowing what to do with a family, they just don't have any natural ability to know how to handle situations. And abusive families come in and out of churches, and they are there everywhere, and lo and behold, people think everything is fine, but the appearance is one thing, and reality is quite another. Another characteristic is that facts are disregarded. Facts are disregarded. I've already implied that. And so we shall hurry to number 4. The victim's cries, this is very important, the victim's cries are not heard. Now look at here. Here's what happened. I'm picking it up in verse 11. When she brought them to him to eat, he took hold of her and said, come lie with me, my sister. She answered him, she really says no 3 times. No, my brother, do not violate me. Another, no, these things are not done so in Israel, and do not do this outrageous thing. As for me, where could I carry my shame? As for you, you would be one like the outrageous fools of Israel. Therefore, now, please, speak to the king. He will not withhold me from you. What she's implying is, if you talk to her father, he may allow us to marry. She's probably buying time here. Verse 14, but he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. One of the things about abusers that they always want to do is to show their power. They want to make sure that the person that they are abusing is weak and powerless. Powerlessness to them is very important. And that's why a child who's abused may actually go with the abuser and be obedient to the abuser. And people say, well, why don't they run away? The bonding is such, the humiliation is such, that they feel that they should stay and continue the abuse. The psychological insights to unpack that are interesting, but we must hurry on. And so she says no three times, but he disregards it. Abusers don't listen. The father who's abusing that little boy, slapping him, whatever, he disregards the crying of the child who says, no, daddy, no, daddy, no, daddy. He has no ears to hear that. That's the characteristics of an abuser. Later on, I'm going to be giving some hope to you who are abusers, because I know that you're out there. But until I get to the end of the message, I have a word for you until we get there. And if you're an abuser, I want you to hear me carefully. Stop it. Stop what you are doing. Who do you think you are to be abusing anyone, whether it's your wife or your children? Stop it. All right, the victim's cries are not heard. We must hurry on. Number five, the victim is shamed, blamed, and demeaned. Now notice what the text says. Amnon hated her with a very great hatred, verse 15, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. I mean, isn't that interesting? Maybe it wasn't all that he thought it was going to be, the experience. There are other dynamics that are going on. It happens 1,000 times in Chicago every week, if not more. Gets what he wants, and now he throws her away like the peeling of an orange. Well, she says, no, she doesn't want to go. She says, if you send me away, I'm going to be desolate for the rest of my life. He tosses her out, asks the servants to bolt the door, and as far as Tamar is concerned, she is ostracized and will be an outcast in Israel. Now notice it says in verse 19, we must skip to there, Tamar put ashes on her head, tore the long robe that she wore, and as she laid her hands on her head, she went away crying aloud as she went. And her brother Absalom said to her, has Amnon your brother been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart. Actually, Absalom is now planning to kill Amnon. And that's about the best comfort he could give his sister, his full-blooded sister. Verse 21, when King David heard about it, he was very angry. Well, good for you, David. And what is it exactly that you're going to do about it? Answer, nothing. You know that Amnon should have been put to death according to the law. The guy should have been stoned. But Amnon is going to become, theoretically he never was, but he was in line to become the king after David as one of his firstborns. And so David backs off. David is not a good father. I know that there are some of you who say, you can't say such things about David. Oh yeah, I can. I just did, as a matter of fact. You know, there's a hint in 2 Kings chapter 1, verse 6. It speaks about Adonijah, another son, who's going to have to be put to death because he has a rebellion against Solomon. And it says regarding Adonijah and his rebellion, never did the king cross him or ever speak to him, why are you doing thus or so? David should have acted differently. Even if he had not put Amnon to death, what he should have done is hurried over to Tamar and say, Tamar, I am absolutely heartbroken over what has happened to you. This is not your fault. Why don't you let me write a psalm about you? Because, you know, I do write psalms, and I want it to be a psalm of lament, but also a psalm of hope. And Tamar, I'm going to be here with you in your emotional distress. I'm going to walk with you through your experience. How differently it would have turned out for Tamar. But the famous King David, the author of the Psalms, didn't do that. He was angry. Maybe because of the moral compromise of chapter 12, he had lost his ability to have moral input into the lives of his family. The dysfunctional family keeps going. Now, when the father doesn't do anything, the kids take care of it. They all respond differently. Absalom ends up killing Amnon and so forth. Now, the question that we have to ask is, was Tamar's problem, I know it wasn't really hers, but was her shame ever redeemed? We don't know for sure, but look at what it says there. I read it to you a moment ago. Tamar lived a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. In those days, that would have meant that even though it wasn't her fault, she was in effect damaged goods, and as damaged goods, she would never have the opportunity of marrying and of bearing children. I suspect she dies, as the text describes her, desolate woman, ostracized from society. And that is her story. Now, the question that I want to ask is, could she have been redeemed? That is to say, could God have redeemed her story? Maybe he did, because we don't know how her life ended. I hope that he did. But if he would have, one way that he would have been able to pour grace into her soul. She didn't have as much information as we do. She lived, of course, before the cross. We live after the cross. She lived before the prophets wrote. She may have known some of her father's psalms, but I don't know how much she knew. But today my heart breaks for Tamar, and my heart breaks for all the Tamars who are listening to me right now. The Tamar of the past can't be helped, but you can be. And I want to encourage you to let God redeem your story. Let's take our Bibles and go to Isaiah chapter 61 for just a few moments. Isaiah 61, where Jesus actually defines his mission. He defines his mission as rebuilding of the soul. And I want to have God, I want you to give permission to God to rebuild your soul, no matter what kind of abuse you've endured. Jesus quotes this in the fourth chapter of the book of Luke when he goes into the synagogue and picks up the scroll. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because the Lord has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, the Tamars of this world, to proclaim liberty to the captives, the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. The last part of verse 2 will come later, the day of vengeance. But verse 3, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the garment of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they might be called the oaks of the Lord, the oaks of righteousness. Now, what I want us to do is to see quickly that there are three statements here that would have really helped Tamar, and they are in God's word because they can help you. Notice God says, I'm going to substitute instead of ashes. You remember I read that Tamar put ashes on her head? That was symbolic of her shame. God says, instead of ashes, he says, I am going to give them a beautiful headdress, a garland, so that ashes are not going to define who you are, but rather the garland that was a garland of beauty on festive occasions. That's who you really are going to become. Isn't that beautiful? I invite you today to get rid of the ashes of shame, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Well, my friend, this is Pastor Lutzer, and I sure hope that you join us on Running to Win next time, because you'll hear the continuation of this message that was preached here at the Moody Church. during a time of abuse, during a time when people grow up with a great deal of anger, God is able to reach down and to bring healing. You stay tuned, because in a moment I'm going to be answering a question that was sent to us by one of our listeners, and I look forward to seeing you right here next time.
It's time now for another chance for you to ask Pastor Lutzer a question about the Bible or the Christian life. For many believers, life becomes tedious, even painful. They begin to long for their eternal home. David is one such listener. He asks this: what is your opinion about a Christian praying to God to go ahead and take him home to heaven? I'm ready to go and have been asking God for some time to take me home. Is this a scriptural thing to do or to pray for?
Yes, I think it is scriptural. You know, while I'm speaking about this, my mother is 102. She greatly desires that she would go home to glory. And even though I've not heard her pray that she will, I think that there's no doubt but that she prays that regularly. You know, the Apostle Paul says in Philippians chapter 1 that he desired to be with Christ, which is far better. So I can imagine that if you desire to be with Christ, you're going to pray that you're going to be with Christ. But the bottom line is this: you must always let God make the final decision. Don't try to hurry the process, because God has not lost your address, as you might think that he has. He has a purpose for you. So what you do is you share with God the desire of your heart to be with him. But at the same time, as the Apostle Paul did, you accept the fact that God makes that decision, and Paul says to abide in the flesh is much more needful for you. I want to die, but God has a purpose for me. Let God be God.
Thank you, David, and thank you, Pastor Lutzer. If you'd like to hear your question answered, go to our website at rtwoffer.com and click on Ask Pastor Lutzer, or call us at 1-888-218-9337. That's 1-888-218-9337.
My uncle stepped in and played the role of genuine, kind-hearted, caring, and I just want to be around children because I can't have my own.
Boys are sexually abused in vast numbers and vastly more frequently than as a society we're recognizing.
I remembered the sounds of pictures. I didn't know how many photographs. I just remembered the Polaroid sound. So we broke in his house and found the photographs. And the younger photographs, I hadn't even lost my baby teeth.
I just experienced many symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, and I thought it was just uniquely me.
The older the abuse got and the older I got, the more abusive he got.
I was absolutely amazed that, in fact, it was so common among sexual abuse survivors of feeling alone or feeling it was only you.
I want you to know that you can invite God to go into dark places with you. You don't have to go alone.
Dr. Erwin Lutzer wants you to let God redeem your story.
Because the Bible says that the love of God is ever with us, and nothing can separate us from his love, even the things that were so maliciously and directly done against you by those who should have been protecting you. You can go to dark places with God.
Let God redeem your story. 3 life-changing messages that might transform someone you know. They'll be sent to you on CD as our way of saying thanks for your gift of any amount to support Running to Win. Call right now at 1-888-218-9337. That's 1-888-218-9337. Or write to Running to Win, Moody Church, 1635 North LaSalle Boulevard, Chicago, Illinois, 60614. Online, reach us at rtwoffer.com. That's rtwoffer, all one word, .com. Those who have a conscience can feel shame, that sense of embarrassment when caught in a sinful act. There's also the painful shame that victims of sexual abuse bear, often for life. Next time on Running to Win, join us to learn how to handle both kinds of shame. For Dr. Erwin Lutzer, this is Dave McAllister. Running to Win is sponsored by the Moody Church.